I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Greg Mortensen, founder of the Central Asian Institute, an organization responsible for establishing schools mostly for girls in northern Pakistan and Afghanistan. Greg is a former mountaineer who has devoted his life to promoting peace through education. Greg founded the Central Asian Institute in 1993, and the organization has developed clean water projects, vocational centers, and schools for girls in the world's most volatile and illiterate regions. The book Three Cups of Tea tells the story of Greg's journey from mountaineer to humanitarian. I recorded this interview with Greg in May 2010, before allegations developed against him in April 2011. The charges include fabricating stories in his books and misusing funds from his organization to promote his books. Welcome.
Hi, Jessica. Nice to be with you today.
Greg, in 1993, you were in Pakistan descending K2, which is the world's second tallest mountain. And after a failed attempt at reaching the summit, you took a wrong turn off the trail and ended up in a remote village of Corfe. And that wrong turn changed your life. What did you see in Corfe that resonated with you so much?
Well, what struck me first was the hospitality of the people, the very impoverished people. They also live at the end of the road, or say the frontiers of civilization. And it was mostly that they took me in. I was a stranger there. They fed me. They gave me everything they had. And one day I walked behind the village. I saw 84 children sitting in the dirt during their school lessons. It was about 5 girls and 79 boys, and most of the children were riding with a stick in the sand. So when a young girl named Chocho came up to me and said, "Could you help us build a school?" I made a very rash promise that day, and I said, "I promise I'll build a school for you."
Were they used to seeing foreigners?
No, I'd actually taken a wrong turn, and I went south instead of north, and I went into this village, so I was one of the first foreigners who had stumbled into the village. And I also was very emaciated. My pants were ripped. I hadn't taken a bath in 84 days, so I must have been quite a sight, you know, to see this tall Angrez, a white man, coming in with ripped pants into a village. I was also struck by the fact that those kids in the dirt doing their lessons, there was no teacher there. I asked them, "Where's your teacher?" And they pointed to the next village, Munjung, where he spent half the week because they couldn't afford his daily $1 salary.
Starting a school was in your DNA to some extent. Your mother had started a school in Tanzania and your father had started a hospital. Can you tell me a little bit about your past in Tanzania?
Well, I grew up in Tanzania. I was born in Minnesota, Garrison Keillor stock, Minnesota Norwegian Lutheran. But when I was 3 months old, my parents went to Tanzania. My father ended up starting a hospital called the Kilimanjaro Christian Medical Center, and my mother started a school. So in my childhood, I did have a background of service and watching my parents toil to get the school and hospital set up. And I think the other thing I learned from my father was he always insisted on having local people in charge of the hospital, and that often didn't go very well with the Americans and Europeans because they said you need a qualified Mzungu or a white man to run the hospital, but my father insisted that Africans be in charge. So I guess the lesson that people can be empowered, and that's kind of in our philosophy now when we do projects. We first work with the people and we empower them, but we let them run the show.
When you reached Corfe and this little girl comes up to you and asks to build a school, what was your state of mind professionally? I mean, you had experienced this failed attempt at K2. What was waiting for you at home, and where was home?
Well, I was living in the Bay Area in California. I was totally broke. I was a trauma nurse. I did have work that I could do. I was also a graduate student. I was studying neurophysiology, the study of epilepsy. And I wanted to get into epilepsy research because of my sister Krista, who had died from epilepsy. But I was without a goal at that point. I thought I was going to climb K2 to honor my sister who had died from epilepsy. And then when I didn't get to the top, my two partners did summit, but I didn't quite make it to the top. And that's the title of Three Cups of Tea, is the word failure. I use that because I think many of our successes in life are based in failure or making mistakes. I came off rather, without a sense of direction and purpose, and little did I know that there was a bigger purpose in my going there was to help the people.
You were homeless at the time. You were living out of your car in San Francisco. When you would return from a climb, you would sleep in a self-storage stall. Is that right?
Once I made a promise to build a school, I came back to the Bay Area. I worked a lot. I also wrote 580 letters to raise money, but I also lived in my car, but it was to save money. It was a way to save every penny I could to get this school started. I used to also crash on people's floors, and I'm also very comfortable living in tents. This is nothing unusual for me.
You decided to start a school for girls. How come for girls versus for girls and boys?
Well, in Africa, as a child, I learned a proverb, and I've never forgotten the proverb. It says, if we educate a boy, we educate an individual. But if we can educate a girl, we educate a community. And the more that I do this, I'm convinced that while education has to be our top national and international priority, but especially educating girls, educating girls reduces infant mortality, reduces the population explosion. Girls who can learn how to read and write, they often tend to teach their mothers how to read and write, so it becomes kind of a community thing. Also, when women who are educated are less likely to encourage their son to get into violence or into terrorism, and I've seen that happen over the last decade. The Taliban, their primary recruiting grounds are illiterate, impoverished society, so I mean, educating girls has profound benefits in many different areas of life.
Was this accepted immediately in Corfe? Haji Ali was the leader of the village. Was he amenable to this immediately?
Haji Ali was amenable, and it was ironic because he was very conservative and he lived beyond the scope of any media or any newspaper. But in many areas, the mullahs, the illiterate mullahs, are very reluctant to have girls go to school. They feel that women should work like chattel, and they're meaningless other than for having babies and working. So we've had to overcome many obstacles in order to get girls to go to school.
And the Quran advocates educating both men and women.
Yeah, in the Holy Quran, the first word of the revelation to Muhammad the prophet is the Arabic word ikra, which means read. And there's nothing in the Quran that says girls can't go to school. In fact, many citations from the Quran or the Hadith, which is a part of Islam, specify that people should go out and seek the truth, or meaning get an education.
We're talking about Haji Ali, who was the mullah of Corfe. He was willing to let you establish a school for women. He was illiterate. Can you speak a little bit about that and how you found out he was illiterate?
Well, I didn't know he was illiterate for about 10 years. Every evening he would sit on a little rickety bed called a charfoy, and he had a thick goggle glasses and a little kerosene lantern, and then he would read either the Quran or Persian poetry. But I noticed after I got to know him a while, he seemed despondent when he read or sad, and he would also have a tear in his eye sometimes. So one day I asked Haji Ali, why are you sad when you read? And he looked at me with tears in his eyes. He said, Greg, I don't know how to read. I'm illiterate and I memorize these books. And he showed me how, like in the books, he had flipped the pages every fourth page or put in twigs or piece of paper or marked in the book. He said, it's my life's greatest sadness that I never learned how to read and write, and my life's greatest hope that my children and my grandchildren can learn to read and write. And that's kind of a profound message to the whole universe, that an illiterate man knew education is the key for all people.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Greg Mortensen, founder of the Central Asian Institute, an organization responsible for establishing approximately 150 schools, mostly for girls, in northern Pakistan and in Afghanistan. So you say, okay, I don't have much going on back in the United States. I'm going to found a school for girls in Corfe in Pakistan. And you went back to California, and you tried raising money. You mentioned that you wrote over 500 letters.
Well, I hand-typed. I didn't know I used a computer at the time. So I hand-typed 500 letters, and I went to the local library, and I looked up the name of celebrities and movie stars. So I hand-typed these 500 letters. And I only got one check back from Tom Brokaw, the newscaster, for $100. And And then I ended up selling my car, which I had inherited from my grandpa. I sold my climbing gear, and I sold my books, Black Oak Bookstore in Berkeley. So it was very painful to sell all your books, a really big markdown. Mm-hmm. And by springtime, I'd raised about $3,000. And my mother, who was an elementary school principal in Wisconsin, invited me to come and talk to the kids there. And this is in the spring of 94, and a fourth grader named Jeffrey came up to me afterwards, and he said, "I have a piggy bank at home, and I'm going to help you." And, you know, I thought, well, what can this fourth grader do? But 6 weeks later, they had raised 62,340 pennies. So that's really what got us started, is a fourth grader and his pennies.
Didn't you also finally borrow a computer from a Pakistani living in Berkeley?
Yeah, it was a Pakistani gentleman named Keish, who's from Multan, Pakistan. He runs a laser image on Shattuck Avenue. It's a copy center. And one day I went to rent typewriter there, like $1 an hour. And he looked at one day, he said, "What are you doing?" I said, "Well, I'm trying to raise money for a school in Pakistan." And so he taught me how to use a computer. It was quite funny. Here's a illiterate Pakistan shopkeeper who knows how to use a computer teaching an American who's illiterate on a computer to write letters to raise money for illiterate children in Pakistan.
You mentioned that despite your ambitious letter-writing campaign, you only got a check from Tom Brokaw, and although you did raise money from these children from your mom's school, where did the $12,000 come from that you said would cost to build the school?
Well, eventually, a year later, I was getting ready to go back to Pakistan. I was still quite short of funds, and Swiss physicist named Jean Harney, who invented the planar process in 1957, which was the prototype of the original microchip, he called me up and he heard about what I was doing, and he wrote a check that funded the final amount for the school. And when he sent me the check, he just wrote these three words: "Don't screw up, Jean." So hopefully I've fulfilled his legacy that I didn't screw up with the first school.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Greg Mortensen, founder of the Central Asian Institute and author of the New York Times bestselling book, Three Cups of Tea. This interview was recorded in May 2010, a year before the allegations against him in April 2011 that he fabricated stories in his books and misappropriated the funds from his institute to promote his books. We'll hear more from Greg Mortensen coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Greg Mortensen, founder of the Central Asian Institute, an organization responsible for establishing schools mostly for girls in northern Pakistan and Afghanistan. Greg is a former mountaineer who has devoted his life to promoting peace through education. Greg founded the Central Asian Institute in 1993, and the organization has developed clean water projects, vocational centers, and schools for girls in the world's most volatile and illiterate regions. The book Three Cups of Tea tells the story of Greg's journey from mountaineer to humanitarian. I recorded this interview with Greg in May 2010, before allegations developed against him in April 2011. The charges include fabricating stories in his books and misusing funds from his organization to promote his books. So you have this $12,000 now in your pockets, and you go back to Pakistan. Talk to me about how you spent that money.
Well, I was very careful. I didn't want to spend a spare dime, so when I went to the bazaar, I befriended some people, and they bargained ruthlessly, which now I've learned is part of the culture in Pakistan and Afghanistan. And I had calculated basically down to the last dollar how I'd get the money and spend it. But there's also a lot of obstacles, like getting the supplies up to the village. And so it was kind of painful to watch this money go away without having done anything yet. And then when I finally got to Corfe, Haji Ali, he didn't think I was coming back. He said, "We thought, you know, your promise was you would never show up, and you did show up. But if we really want to build a school, we're going to have to build a bridge first."
What was your response to that?
Well, first I was shocked because I was like a horse with blinders on. All I could think about, I got to get the school built. And he, with all earnesty, said, "We have to build a bridge first. Look at this. How are we going to get these supplies over the river?" And so then and I also spent 6 months there over the winter learning the language. I learned more about the culture and the people. But I realized when leaving that I had to raise $10,000 more. We'd have to build about a 300-foot bridge to get the supplies across the Brawler River in order to get the school built.
What, by the way, when you ultimately did build the bridge, what impact did that have on maternal ties in the region?
Well, I only built the bridge to get the supplies to the school, but I didn't realize that there were bigger implications. One, the people could access health care much quicker. And the thing that I hadn't thought about at all was the women who lived on the south side of the valley on the river. When they got married, their maternal ties were severed. And so when the bridge got built, on Fridays, I noticed they would put on their colorful garb and their best clothing and then walk across the bridge and go visit their family or extended families. And for some of the women, it was the first time in decades that they had gone to see their families, even though they lived just, you know, right down the river, but they were able to walk across the bridge. It really helped to empower the women in the whole Brawler Valley.
We talk about, you know, how maternal ties were broken because there was no bridge. But just in detail, like when a woman is about to get married, I mean, she's crying and holding on to her mother for dear life before a ceremony. Did you ever witness that?
Yes, I've been to some weddings, and there's different versions of it. But basically, when the bride, it comes time to take her away from her family to go with the groom's family, you'll see the bride and her mother cling to each other. And then the family of the groom starts to pile up a dowry, you know, these maybe promises of gold or goats or land or sheep or something. And then when the pile gets big enough and the father of the bride is satisfied, he'll nod his head. And at that point, the women from the groom's family come and start to pull the bride away from her mother. And then there's this ceremonial weeping and wailing. But it symbolizes that when that woman leaves her family, often her maternal ties are completely severed, and she will not have any, you know, access to support from her family. So it is, you know, it's very traumatic, and they kind of stage this during the wedding ceremonies.
I'm Jessica Harrison. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Greg Mortensen, director of the Central Asian Institute, an organization responsible for establishing approximately 150 schools in northern Pakistan and Afghanistan. So Haji Ali says we need this bridge, and you ultimately do build it as a means to build the school. But can you talk to me a little bit about your personal health during this time? Because here you're kind of on a mental roller coaster going back and forth between Pakistan and California. And, you know, you thought you were building a school and now you're building a bridge. Can you lend some more color to that?
Well, I never realized what I would get into by building this school, and it was very frustrating because first I had to raise the money, then I went back there, then I had to build a bridge to come back here. And when I got back there, realized the bridge was actually a phenomenal engineering feat. But then I witnessed the men carry 5 800-pound steel cables 18 miles up the mountain trails. They put them on a big wooden spool and carry them, 8 men on their back. And I realized that there was nothing that was going to stop them from getting a school built. But for me, it was definitely an emotional roller coaster.
When you came back home to get the money for the bridge, what was John Herney's reaction when you said, "Oh, I need $10,000 on top of the $12,000 you already gave me"?
Well, he was very angry, very upset. He had leukemia, so he's starting to get, his health was deteriorating. And so he said, "You know, you promised you're going to get the school built, and now, you know, this is going to be another year, and I'm not doing very well. You have to build a school before I die." So there was also urgency on his part to get a school built.
Also, when you came back home, you met your wife. This is before the bridge was built. Can you tell me about how you met your wife?
Well, in 1995, September, I was 38 years old. I was a bachelor. I was at a fundraising dinner in San Francisco, and it was getting pretty late, so I walked to the back. And there in the back was this beautiful woman in a dress, and she had on black combat boots. And I started talking to her. Her name was Tara Bishop, and her father was a mountaineer and the chairman of the Research and Exploration Committee with National Geographic Society. I started talking to her, and 6 days later we got married. And we never regretted that. We just both feel it was meant to be. But that's how I ended up finding my life partner.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Greg Mortensen, founder of the Central Asian Institute, an organization responsible for establishing approximately 150 schools, mostly for girls, in northern Pakistan and Afghanistan. People called you Dr. Greg in Pakistan. Why did they call you Dr. Greg?
Well, sometimes I'm not a doctor. I was a trauma nurse, but sometimes I would help women who were dying from septic shock after birth, or I would help people. There's no health care there, and so the nickname kind of stuck. I keep trying to say I'm not a doctor, but they keep calling me Dr. Girik. So.
You talk about helping women in shock after birth, and I bring this up because it shows the level of trust that the people in Corfe had towards you. Could you tell that story?
When I was starting out building the first school, one of my friends, Ibrahim, he asked me to come to his house. He brought me into the basement, and his wife, Rokia, was in septic shock. It was, a very putrid smell, and she had delivered her first baby, who was barely hanging on, and her pulse was very thready. She was pretty much unconscious, and I figured out that her placenta hadn't passed. And so he asked me what to do, and I said, well, we're going to have to go and get the placenta out of there. And then he said, well, I was reluctant to do it because this is a very conservative Islamic society. And Ibrahim just said, please save my wife for me, and I don't do what you have to do. And I'm a trauma nurse, so we went in and we pulled out her uterus, and we also massaged her fundus, which is the uterus, and Rokia. She lived, and her baby survived. What was unfortunate, though, is what I didn't write about in Three Cups of Tea is when Rokia had her second baby, the same thing happened, and nobody was there, and she died. And so it kind of taught me that you can help people and give them health care, but the key is you have to empower them through education. Rokia was it's very tragic every time I go see Ibrahim because I know his wife perished because I didn't really explain the necessity of nursing and would need to be done afterwards.
Hmm. I want to talk a little more about the opposition that you faced in building the school. While you were fortunate that Hajra Ali was very supportive of you, there were conservative mullahs from the other tribes or villages who were not. And at one point, when you were trying to establish more schools in the Waziristan region, you were captured by the Taliban. Can you describe that experience?
In July 1996, I left Corfe for a while during the final phase of the school building because Haji Ali didn't want me sitting there monitoring everything. And so I decided to find a place to build the next school, and I went to Waziristan, and I went in, say, unannounced, without asking permission. The reason I was captured by them was, first, I went in without their permission, but the most important thing is there was an ongoing dispute between two tribal factions or clans. So when I stumbled into this dispute, I was held by one of the clans as a bartering chip in order to solve their long-term dispute, and that's the real reason I was detained in Waziristan.
When you were detained, what was going through your mind? Did you ever have these existential questions of, why don't I just go back to Montana and be with my family and just live a simple life? What was going on?
Well, I was held for 8 days. I was never tortured, but I wasn't treated that well either. And I first got very depressed because my wife was 7 months pregnant. And all I could think about is surviving, how I could escape or maybe even outsmart or just fight my way out of there. And then I realized after 3 days, there's no way I can get out of here. So I thought the best way to get out of my detention was to befriend my captors. So I first asked them to bring me a Quran and teach me about their faith. And then on the sixth day, I told them my wife is 7 months pregnant and I want to go home for the birth of my firstborn son. And in their culture, life's greatest event is the first son, who's the firstborn. Now, I didn't end up having a daughter, but that happened later. But that really started to change things around when I said, I want to go home for the birth of my son.
Were there other incidences of mullahs who were not supportive of what you were doing?
Well, I've received two fatwas against me, and a fatwa is like an edict. Both were banishing me from the country. The first one was from a Shia imam, and that was rescinded with a letter to the imam saying that in the Quran, nothing says girls can't go to school, and this man is acting in the highest principles of Islam. And the second fatwa was in 2002. It was more severe. It was from a Sunni imam, and he basically not only banished me from the country, but said anybody could destroy our schools and attack them. And that was taken by the community called a hemisil to the Shariat Court of Law, which is in Pakistan. There's the government court and the Shariat Court, the Islamic court. And eventually in the high Shariat court, that was also rescinded with a severe admonishment to the imam saying that what I was doing was not was consistent with Islam to help children go to school.
We talk about opposition by conservative mullahs. What about by the government? I mean, here you were building schools faster, cheaper, better than the Pakistani government was building them. Did the government ever wish you not there, or did they see you as kind of a benefit to them because they weren't doing the job?
Well, I think they somewhat saw me as a benefit to them. At the same time, what they didn't like was that I was empowering people and working at the district level to get unify people, and then who would on a collective basis go to the provincial government or the national government. And they felt that was undermining the credibility of the national government, which originally was basically non-existent where we worked. And there's also so much corruption, and they said, well, you can take care of this by giving us some money, you know, bribe or bakshish, but we've refused to ever give any government official any money.
We're talking about all these schools that you've helped to establish, but let's take the Corfe school, for example. What is the curriculum like, and how has the curriculum changed since the first school was built?
I say our curriculum is far different than originally we had in Corfe. We have the standard reading, writing, arithmetic, and science that the governments require. We also teach, well, at first they speak their native tongue, but we teach four additional languages. And we not only teach the kids how to read Arabic, though we teach them how to read, write, and understand Arabic. And that's a big difference between extremist madrasas. When kids learn how to read and write and understand Arabic, they'll find out that in the Quran, you know, nothing says girls can't go to school. Then we have hygiene, sanitation, nutrition. And then the other thing we do in our schools, which is rather unique, is we have the elders come in two or three times a week and do the storytelling tradition. Because I think the one negative thing about literacy is it often eradicates the very rich traditions in indigenous societies. And I actually started that because of what I saw in U.S. schools. I always ask kids in U.S. schools, how many of you have spent more than about 10 hours talking to your grandparents about the Depression or World War II or the Civil Rights Movement? And very consistently, the average in the U.S. is 5 to 10%. Now, if you ask the same question in Pakistan or Afghanistan in a rural school, they will 90% of the kids or 100% put their hands up. So we don't want that tradition to go away where they learn about their folklore and their culture and their heritage.
I want to change gears a little bit and talk about September 11th. You were in Pakistan during that time. Can you talk to me about where you were when you found out about the World Trade Center?
I was in 9/11, 9/12. I was in a very remote valley called Charpusan. It's on the Afghan-Pakistan border in the tribal areas. I didn't find out till about maybe 30 hours later. There's no phone there. There's no TV. There's no nothing there. And the first thing I had heard was that a village called New York has been bombed and 50,000 people were killed. And then more kind of rumors, and so I asked for a satellite phone, which was about a day away, and some people brought that by jeep and horseback, and then I called my wife and I found out what had happened. And my initial reaction and the people there was we were afraid that the U.S. would start bombing indiscriminately. And then later what happened was the Americans were ordered or asked to leave the country, but I decided to stay there because I had so much work to do, and I was befriended by the people. And I remember a very elderly widow named Hawa who brought me 5 eggs at the opening of a school on September 14th, and she said, could you give this to the widows in New York who are suffering? And she said, I'm sorry, this is all I have to give, but please share this with the widows in New York. And that's kind of what I saw the weeks after 9/11.
You were very vocal about not wanting Americans to view all Muslims as the same, and this was kind of perceived controversially, and you received a lot of hate mail when you returned home in Montana. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I just said this is a very complex issue, and that the real enemy is ignorance, and that most people there were not responsible at all for what had happened in New York. And And that, then I started getting hate mail and death threats from Americans. And it was the only time I thought about quitting my work. And it was my wife, Tara, who said, you know, you need to go out in public and talk about what you're doing. And that's what I did. And over the years, what I found is that Americans were very generous people and we're very compassionate people. And I also think, though, we're way too much living in fear, and we're spending billions and billions of dollars to build walls around a country when we should be reaching out and building bridges of peace, literally and figuratively.
You faced a lot of challenges, obviously, in launching the first school and the hundreds of schools after. What for you has been the biggest obstacle?
The hardest part for me in this whole endeavor is, you know, it's not in my genes to go out in public and be in front of people, and I'm a really shy guy. I've now been Capitol Hill many times. I help brief our top military commanders. I'm a big advocate for girls' education. I generally, when I speak now, we have between 2 and 10,000 people show up, and I have to sign books for 3 to 6 hours afterwards. And it even psychologically, I get shut down sometimes by having to do this so much. And you know, it's mostly because of my wife's support. But it does. We have people in Pakistan, Afghanistan who threaten us, and here in the U.S. we also have people who threaten us. But on the other hand, I get to have the great joy of watching a child, you know, writing their name with a stick in the sand for the first time, or seeing a young woman go back to her village and prevent hundreds of women from dying in childbirth. So to me, it's all worth it.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thanks, Jessica.
My guest has been Greg Mortensen, founder of the Central Asian Institute, an organization responsible for establishing approximately 150 schools, mostly for girls in northern Pakistan and Afghanistan. This interview was recorded in May 2010, a year before the allegations against him in April 2011 that he fabricated stories in his books and misappropriated the funds from his institute to promote his books. Coming up, we'll meet Sam Farber, founder of OXO, a leading kitchenware company. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Sam Farber, founder of OXO, the international kitchenware company that makes tools with rubber-like handles called Good Grips. Sam also founded another cookware company in 1960 called Kopko, with products of enameled cast iron and enameled steel. Sam's career has been about designing universal human-centric products for all ages and capacities. So a carrot peeler that works for a 30-year-old should also work comfortably for a 70-year-old with arthritis. OXO sells over 500 products and has extended beyond the kitchen to the garden and the barbecue. Welcome.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
You started OXO at what stage of your life?
I was 65 years old. I had retired in 1988 from Kopko. And one of my dreams had always been to go and live in France for a while. So Betsy, my wife and I, rented a house in Provence and spent 2 months of the year for 3 years there.
So what was the catalyst then for leaving retirement and starting OXO?
We do cook a lot. And one of the days, Betsy turned to me and said, why can't somebody make a kitchen tool that's comfortable? Betsy has some arthritis in her hands. And I said, that's a wonderful idea. And so the first thing we did, actually, was to go and buy some clay, some modeling clay, and put it around the handles of the various tools we could find in the stores in France. Made them larger. We had a whole refrigerator full of handles with modeling clay on them. And finally decided that it was a good idea. And so I got on the phone and called David Stoll, who is head of smart design and with whom I'd worked before, and said, I have this wonderful idea, David. I think it's a good idea. Let me run it by you. And I spoke to him about the idea of making a line of kitchen tools with a soft, comfortable handle. It wasn't just the comfortable handle. We wanted a good product that was easy to use, that was dishwasher safe, and fairly well priced, we hope. Mm-hmm. As it turned out, there were peelers selling for 99 cents. We came out at $5.99, I believe, and people looked at it and said, oh, no one will ever pay that price for a peeler. Well, they paid it.
Were you itching at all to start a business, or were you kind of content in your retirement?
I think I was itching to start a business. A very good question. I enjoyed myself, but I think somewhere deep inside, was this knowledge that I wasn't going to retire and ski and play tennis or do something else.
So what did you do to come up with that first peeler?
Well, the first thing we did was to observe people using kitchen tools. And because we were interested in doing it for a wide body of consumers, we didn't want to make a prosthetic device for a few people. We wanted to make something that everybody could use. It was called universal design at that point. They studied people in New York with the New York Arthritis Society. And then the other end of the spectrum, they studied chefs working with it.
Did you have a problem with marketing because people thought that it was just a geriatric product?
No, I think the problem we had in marketing may have been more than getting used to a very fat handle. It was different from all other handles, and also probably some price sensitivity.
Now, you have a material on your products that looks like rubber, but it's actually called santoprene. What is santoprene?
It's a combination of polypropylene and rubber, actually. I know it was used in the automotive field. We were the first ones to use it in our field, actually. So many people copied us afterwards and used it in the field for everything.
Now, how did you go about manufacturing the product?
I knew someone who had a factory in New Jersey making the bicycle handles, which had the same idea in many ways because they had the thin fins at the top of the handle that we had. And the engineers looked at it and said, we can't do it. It can't be made. Those fins are too thin. We'll never get a decent product out of it. Being an entrepreneur and having an idea and then you never stop because you want to see that idea come to fruition, I got in touch with people I'd worked with in Japan, and the owner of the factory in Japan looked at it and said, very interesting. Surely we can do it. And they did it easily.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Sam Farber, the founder of OXO, a leading kitchenware company of transgenerational products that are easy to use. OXO has won many awards, including from the Arthritis Foundation, and OXO's Good Grips have been selected for permanent collections at the Museum of Modern Art, among others. Now, before you started OXO, you actually had a career in cooking and kitchenware.
I decided I wanted to go into something in the home area. I had been working in a family business for 9 years. We got along well, but that it wasn't where I wanted to be and what I wanted to do. I wanted to be on my own. I was on a train to a Harvard-Yale game and was talking about going into business, and the wife of my college roommate said, why doesn't someone make a beautifully designed line of cast iron cookware? There isn't such a thing. It's all traditional, and no one does it in modern design. Marvin Traub, who was at Bloomingdale's at the time and later became chairman of Bloomingdale's, said, that's a wonderful idea. Why don't you go and see the buyer in our gourmet department? Hmm. Which I did. He was excited about it, and I decided to make it. So I investigated and got in touch with people I knew in Europe and went to Europe and visited a number of factories. A designer in Denmark, Acton Bjorn, told me about a factory in northern Denmark, and I made an appointment, went to see them, and I got there, and it was a marvelous old factory. They said they could do it. After a year, we finally managed to get a product.
How adventurous. This was in 1960. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Yonkers, New York.
What was the state of design, at least in the houseware field, in 1960, when you were first starting out? What was design?
It was a desert. People were just set in their ways, well, what they did, and they thought that by changing a color, they changed the design, actually.
Do you think it had anything to do with a lot of people coming out of the Depression era and after World War II?
Well, I think that that might have some bearing upon it because when World War II ended, there was a hungry market there. And so you didn't have to worry about making great advances in design, and innovation, let's say, in general. So there may have been a number of years where people sat back and just said, well, we can sell everything we make. Look at the car industry. That's a perfect example of it, you know. They were there so far, they just went on doing the same thing they'd done. And finally, they lost out, as they're losing out now, to people who thought about design. I drive a Prius, Toyota Prius, and it's wonderful.
Speaking of things related to World War II, you were in World War II.
Yes, I was. Mm-hmm.
Where did you serve?
Majority of time in North Africa and Libya, and southern Turkey. I was not in combat. everyone who was there was willing to go home, actually. But I did have it easy, I must say. I can't complain about the time. It was just a lot out of your life, really. For instance, when I came back to college, I had a lot of credits. If I'd had to do over again, I wouldn't have taken those credits. Mm-hmm. I would have stayed in college and gone through a normal college education. Mm-hmm. This way, I was just sort of floating around trying to get out of college mm-hmm. at the time.
Where did you go to college?
Harvard.
And what did you think you were doing when you got out of college?
Well, first of all, I thought when I went into college that I would be a lawyer. And I did go to Harvard Law School for two semesters. Sitting one day in a contracts class, I said to myself, why am I here? I'm bored. And went on training program at Abraham & Strauss, a department store in Brooklyn at that time. I decided I would go with the family business. It was more lucrative at that time.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Sam Farber, the founder of OXO, a kitchenware company that makes easy-to-use products with human-centered designs. The company was founded in 1990 and has over 500 products and $120 million in sales. Now, we keep talking about human-centered designs and universal designs. What does that mean?
Well, it basically is considering the broadest spectrum of the populace when you make the design.
What are some examples of consumers who have benefited from these universal designs?
We used to get a lot of letters from people thanking us for making OXO peelers and OXO products. One of the ones that we remember very well is the woman who said that she gave a peeler to her grandmother, and the grandmother was able, it was a spoon actually, not a peeler, one of our mixing spoons, and that the grandmother was able to make brownies for the first time in many years for her grandchildren.
Did you have any issues with competition once you presented these products to the market? Would people try to copy OXO?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Within 6 months, there were other products in the market that were copying of OXO, loads of them. When it was possible, we did sue. We won some cases, or so people folded before the cases, actually.
It seems like lawsuits or the notion of litigation gives me such a headache, and it's such an expensive process. Mm-hmm. Did you ever feel like, oh, I don't necessarily want to spend the money, and maybe we should just go head-to-head with them? Or were you adamant about going to court with them?
We were somewhat adamant, but again, we were a tiny company with limited resources. And that's, of course, the larger companies take advantage of that because they know you won't sue because you can't afford all the money to go to court, really. So you sue where you really, really, really know you're going to win. For instance, we had a company in Canada who actually copied it, the peeler exactly, but they made the mistake of photographing our peeler for their package.
Whoa.
Okay. Yeah. And it showed there was a slight difference of some kind, and they just folded right away. I mean, they knew that, and we sent us $150,000 immediately. And that's a case where you would sue. But there are the cases where the borderline cases, you were hesitant to sue, really. So the really best way was to do what I've said many times, is to compete basically by doing innovative product and doing it quickly ahead of the market all the time. And that's what OXO does today.
Now, when you say about doing it quickly, you mean being the first mover, getting out there before other people. Some people say that being the first mover is actually a disadvantage because you don't have time to work out the kinks, and the second guy to come along, as you say, gets the cheese.
The second mouse gets the cheese.
There we go.
I don't believe in it, really. Basically, what happens is that the market gets to know that you're the people to look to for a new product. Look what's come out of OXO over the past few years. There's a marvelous salad spinner. A great story behind it, if I may tell it.
Please.
We mentored projects in graduate business schools at Harvard and Babson primarily, where you put together designers, business school people, and if you can, engineers. The salad spinner came out of a project at Babson. One of the business school people was playing with a Fisher-Price toy, I believe. You press up and down a top or something like that, and got excited about it and said, we can actually make the salad spinner this way. And that's where it came from. That the innovative product way ahead of the market all the time. And so you build a brand that way. OXO did no advertising. It was primarily about people buying one OXO product and realizing that all OXO products were very unusual and satisfied their needs.
I read an interesting story about when OXO entered Japan. The products seemed so big to the consumer. In fact, the salad spinner was called a restaurant-sized salad spinner because, you know, they use products that are much smaller. They hold a spatula like a pen, whereas Americans hold a spatula like a tennis racket.
Yes, that's true.
So OXO had to kind of re-innovate to fit that market.
That would have been after my time, certainly. But it brings up another interesting part of the design world, which is the cultural aspect. In thinking about design, you take into consideration the physical, the cognitive. We're working on the emotional right now. You want design to give you a feeling of joy and accomplishment, not fear, anger, and frustration, actually. And so we're just sort of thinking a lot about that right now. And the cultural fits in with that as well.
What is your interaction with design on a daily basis?
I think about design. I was going to write a book with Patricia Moore, who's a designer and gerontologist. We haven't gotten around to it yet. It was called Ouch, Bad Design Hurts. And when you went through the entire day and pointing out bad design, I'll give you for instance of that. You wake up in the morning, your alarm clock rings, you can't find the button to turn it off. Now, why can't someone's going to make it after I say this, of course, why can't there be one big red light that pops up in the dark so you can turn it off? And as you go through the whole day and you're a design thinker, and that's what I do, and go in the bathroom and see everything wrong in that bathroom. It's fascinating.
What is wrong in that bathroom? What's an example?
Oh, well, they still have, you know, round knobs on doors, so when you come out with the slippery hands, you can't turn the knob around, for instance. That's a typical thing in the bathroom. As you go in the kitchen, we bought a toaster oven a few years ago, and it had a round white dial on it. And the marking where it was the arrow was a little faint indentation in it, and I couldn't see it. And so Betsy went in the bathroom, got her red nail polish, and made that into a red dot so I could see at that point. And you can't imagine why a designer would design something like that. They're not thinking about the user at that point. And to me, it's very fascinating.
I'm Jessica Harrison. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Sam Farber, the founder of OXO, a kitchenware company that makes easy-to-use products with human-centered designs. The company was founded in 1990 and has over 500 products and $120 million in sales. You really incorporated your family into the business, into OXO. What role did your wife and your son play in the business?
Well, Betsy looked over my shoulder in the room that we were using for a year as we were getting going. So she became part of it. She is an architect, along with being many other things, poet. So she did the PR, worked on the packaging and the printed material in general. And when I started the company, my son John, who was in Wall Street at that time, was very fascinated by it and was an investor in it. When we showed in San Francisco, he came to see what was going on and got so excited about it that he decided to leave Wall Street and join us.
Some people might be reluctant to bring family members into the business just because of all the complicated relationships that might result. What were your feelings about that?
I'd worked for my father, who was a very wonderful guy, loved him dearly, but I disagreed with him most of the time. And I thought that it was not great to have family in the business and didn't invite my sons into the business at any time. We got along. It was okay. I don't really feel that you can isolate the emotional aspects, family emotional aspects, from your daily life and business. And that's a problem that you face. John and I are still together. We still do consulting. If I did it over again, well, if they wanted to come, I would say I welcome them in. But I don't think it's great. Other people can manage it very well, really. Mm-hmm. It may be my personality that doesn't manage it, really. So Betsy and I manage it with a little family therapy, and it worked out quite well, actually.
You mentioned before we were talking about universal design and it appealing to a broader spectrum of the populace. Mm-hmm. You also are very interested in outsider art, which in a way also incorporates the broader spectrum of the populace. What is outsider art?
We're still working on that. It's the same question as what is design. But basically, it's art done by untrained artists, self-taught artists, who may be institutionalized, may isolates, eccentrics, being obsessives, although you know, mainstream artists have some of this themselves. I mean, they're obsessed with obsession and passion, passionate, get very close together, you know. But there is a certain otherness about it, let's say, is the word we use, really. I became very passionate about outsider art when I first saw it. I saw it in England in a house, a woman who was an agent for a mainstream artist that I was interested in. And I said, what is that? I'm fascinated by it. It moved me tremendously. And I started to find out about outsider art.
And in your retirement, you spent a lot of time on your interest in outside art. You had a Soho studio.
And being an entrepreneur, I opened a gallery with Rosa Esmond, who had a mainstream gallery in Soho. We ran it for about 2 years, and it was marvelous. It was great fun. We were one of the early people in it, not the earliest, but one of the early people in the field, did wonderful exhibits. And then I realized that you can't keep losing money all the time, so I stopped.
So then you decided to make money by starting OXO.
Yeah, shortly after. You're right. That's about 5 years later, actually, what it amounted to.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure being here.
My guest has been Sam Farber, the founder of OXO, the international kitchenware company that makes tools with rubber-like handles called Good Grips. To learn more about the show, visit our website at fromscratchradio.org, where you can download a podcast on iTunes, follow us on Twitter, or join us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.